Today's Keisho will be on case 33 in the Hikigan Roku, the Hien Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 33 is entitled Chinso Shosho Comes to Visit Shifuku. Engo's introduction. He does not distinguish east from west, nor north from south. From morning to evening, from evening to morning, so he remains. Can he be called asleep? Sometimes his eyes are like shooting stars. Can we call him wide awake? Sometimes he points to the north, calling at the south. Tell me, is he mindful or mindless? Is he a man of enlightenment or of mediocrity? If you thoroughly understand this topic and you know the secret of it, you will realize how the ancient masters went this way and that. Tell me, what season of life is this? See the following. Main subject. Chinso came to see Shifuku. Shifuku drew a circle in the air. Chinso said, I have no object coming here. Why do you bother to draw a circle? Shifuku closed the door of his room. Sucho says, Chinso has only one eye. Sucho's verse. Perfect the circle, pure the sound, bright and abundant the encircling jade, loaded on horses and mules, loaded on board the iron boats given to those who know the peace and freedom of land and sea. He put down the tackle to fish the turtle, Secho comments here, monks throughout the world can't jump out of it. Today is the second day of our spring session, and everybody did a wonderful job this morning. And it's a wonderful day for sitting. You know, sitting here in the Zendo, listening to these winds blow, is quite wonderful. You know, it would be pleasant just to sit and listen to the wind, I think. There's something about it when you really are in the right state of mind that's just thrilling. Ordinarily, people think of the wind as a nuisance. Probably right now on the Weather Channel they're talking about gale force winds and so on and whipping everybody up into a hysteria about this. People are busy doing this and that. So they leave their office and they're getting into their cars, and as they're going, the wind grabs their hats and takes it away or blows at their clothes. Maybe papers go flying. And it's just a nuisance, right? It's something we notice sort of out of the corner of our mind, and then we move on to what we think is really important. If you said to somebody, I spent Thursday just sitting and listening to the wind, yeah, they would think you were crazy, probably, right? Or they wouldn't understand, how you could do that. Maybe that would seem... is that all you did all day long? And I sat and listened to the wind, you know. And yet, it's really quite beautiful to be in samadhi and hear the wind. When the mind is caught up in all kinds of thoughts and projections, we can barely notice something like the wind. You know, so uh, t- typically a person might be caught up in like the internal movies and thoughts that the person might be totally unaware of whether it's day or night sometime. I mean, a friend of mine works at Princeton. He's in the maintenance, building and maintenance at Princeton. And he's an engineer who's worked there all his life. And he said that he knows people in the campus police, and they get calls from people. Campus police get calls from faculty members in the physics department because the physics department people drive to work and they park their car. And during the whole time they're driving to work, they're thinking about their physics, you know. And then they get to work and they're caught up in their debate with other physicists and their difficult calculations. They go into their office and they teach their class somehow. And then they're working away. And at the end of the day, they leave the building because they know it's the end of the day and they're supposed to leave the building. But then they can't remember where they parked their car. Yeah, so this is like a deep absorption in the intellectual world. And actually, there's nothing wrong with this. This is there are some things wrong with this, but it's part of human life to do this. So our ability to make the world disappear and to enter a purely imaginary realm of words and ideas, symbols and concepts, this is something humans can do, you know. And it has changed the whole face of the world in many ways. And we can absorb ourselves so much in it that literally, these poor physicists call the campus police because they can't remember where they parked their car and they can't even remember maybe if they have a car, you know. I was reading the other day about Galileo, the great scientist Galileo, who apparently went up a mountain with a donkey, pulling a donkey, and he was deep in thought about his physics, and then he came down the mountain, and when he got down to the bottom of the mountain, the donkey was gone, and he couldn't remember what happened to the donkey, you know. And now this is probably one of these stories people make up, you know, that really aren't true. But that ability to absorb yourself in fantasy, or let me say imagination, is a very important aspect of human life. Of course, people aren't always physicists. I can remember when I was about 12 or 13, I began to become a reader. I had read books before, but I hadn't really used them to immerse myself in an alternative reality. You know, so when I was about 12 or 13, I started reading books that I found interesting, and I would just lie down on the bed and start reading, and I think I would read for hours. And when I would get up, it really would be like, late afternoon. And the hours were just like gone like that. And I would come out of like a kind of dream, right? I'd be in this book where it was, taking place in England or in Alaska or India. And I would come out and realize, I'm here and I'm on the military base in Southern Virginia, and my mother's going to want me to take out the trash and so on. And so, I would just, it was so much more interesting in the book, really. The book was so much, the people on the military base where I lived were not very interesting people, to tell you the truth, or at least they didn't seem that way at the time. They were mostly in the military, and they were very busy with military things, And they were doing a lot of saluting, a lot of marching, and a lot of flags going up the flagpole and things like that. My father was a very busy chain-smoking guy, and he would come home and to undo his stress, he would have a couple of martinis. So that was a typical life on the military base. But on a Saturday afternoon, there wasn't much to do. You could go to there was a teen club that they made out of an old Quonset hut. And you could go to the teen club and shoot pool, you know, and that was about it. And you could go to the swimming pool. So I would read these books and lose myself in these books, and the books were really amazing, you know, really marvelous. So, you know, not everybody's a physicist, and not everybody likes to read novels. Some people like Dungeons and Dragons and stuff like that. I guess this man, Gary Gygax, just died. I myself have never played Dungeons and Dragons. I have never even played Pac-Man. In fact, some of you probably don't even know what Pac-Man is. But long ago, there was a kind of primitive game called Pac-Man. And there was a little head with a mouth, and it would eat up all these other little creatures. And you could make him go around in a box and eat up everybody. People thought that was great at the time. I didn't understand it. But my brother-in-law, I mean my brother-in-law, my brother's son is an engineer, and he's a very smart young man, and he's a very nice guy, I think. A number of years ago, I was at my brother's house for Thanksgiving. He invited me down to see him, and I went down for Thanksgiving. I got up Thanksgiving morning, and it was all going to take place at my sister's house, actually. We were all going to gather there, but I'd stayed at my brother's house. Anyway, I got up in the morning, and I get up very early to do meditation, so it was probably around 5 o'clock or so. I heard this boom, this like explosions coming from this other room, explosions, boom, 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 boom. You know, I thought, what the hell? You know, so I had, you know. Anyway, my nephew gets up early too to play a game called Diablo. Diablo. Yeah? Do you know Diablo? So you have to kill all these skeletons, and your life essence is used up, and then you have to go to hell and get some more life essence or something. And he was totally, you know, the hours just whipped by, right? You know. So I could be contemptuous. I could say, well, this is a waste of time. But of course, I'm in an English department where, you know, everybody dreams of being able to go home and crack a book and lose themselves in the 18th century of London or something like that. So, you know, you can be a physicist and you can lose yourself in physics, or you can be a reader and lose yourself in a novel, or you can be like a Diablo master, you know, and you can play this game where you chop the heads off of all these skeletons and things like that. Each of these has in common something very interesting, which is that we can make the world disappear and basically immerse ourselves in an imaginary realm. We really don't ever have to fight skeletons, you know. Actually, in reality, skeletons are dead, you know. Okay, so never has a skeleton attacked a human being, you know. So this is like a fantasy realm, right? It could be very exciting, very stimulating, and very absorbing. This is the good and the bad aspect of human beings, because the good aspect of this is that we can imagine things that really don't exist yet, and we can create them. So, you know, maybe some long ago, somebody was sitting in his cave and he was thinking, boy, it's damp in here. There's got to be a better way to live, right? And all of a sudden, like, this vision popped up in his head and he saw, you know, house. You know, I'll shape, the roof will slope down so the rain runs off. I'll have four posts holding it up, you know. And that's, you know, it builds a house. And everybody's, wow, that's a great idea. You know, this is so much better than the cave, you know. So this ability to imagine things that aren't is in some ways our glory as human beings, yeah. And there are other, you know, cases like this, you know, people who get certain kinds of debilitating diseases just die. But you might be a chemist, and you might be a biochemist, and you might think, you know, I can imagine that we could do this, this, and this, and this person wouldn't die. So that's wonderful, right? But on the other hand, you know, we pay a tremendous price for our ability to immerse ourselves in these fantasy realms. Because reality, the world that actually exists, becomes more and more far removed from us, both, you know, personally, and I think also as a society, you know. We have imaginary realms, we create a kind of imaginary world, and little by little, the world, and that you could say the world of nature, the world as it actually is, recedes from view. And I think this is actually not a healthy situation. I think that sooner or later, people become prisoners of their imaginary worlds. And you can say, well, nobody really worries about whether he got a good score in Diablo. But there are all kinds, you know, many things we think of as real really are imaginary worlds too, you know. For example, I've told this story before, but my father was a military officer, and then he went into the civilian part of the government. And in the military, you know, you have a ranking. So you could be the general, right? Or you could be a lieutenant colonel, or a colonel, or a major, or you could be a corporal, or you could be a private, you know? And it's a hierarchy, right? And in the government, they have the same thing. It's called government service, and at the bottom, there's a government, like a government service 5. There's no government service 1. It's just too low, right? So government service 5, and then there's 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and on up to like 20, and then you're like Secretary of State or something like that. Anyway, my father started out as like a government service, when he changed over from the military, he started out as a government service 7. So he wasn't a very highly ranking military person, naval officer. And when he went over to the government, he was very low ranking civil servant. So he worked very hard all his life and smoked many cigarettes and drank many martinis. And eventually he got to be a 13. But really the point at which you get a lot of respect and are really treated like somebody who's made it is a person who's had a 14. See, the 13s are the losers and the 14s are the winners. See, that's true. In that game, this isn't Diablo, this is a different game. This is the game of government service, see? Okay, so now let me just say, in my opinion, it is a fantasy world. In my opinion, that nobody is really a government service 14. Nobody. Let me put it this way. Nobody's essential nature is government service 14. But my father felt that his essential nature was government service 13. And he was a very, very unhappy man because he didn't get to be a 14. And how unhappy? Well, you know, my father's father was a car repair person. You know, he was a mechanic. And my father grew up feeling tremendously, I don't know, my father felt that his father was like a loser, right, fixing cars. And my father thought, I'm going to be better than my father. I'm not going to just be fixing cars. So my father wanted to make it to like the 14 so he could say, I finally arrived, right? I'm going to tell you a little story. I came from a humble beginning, and at the end of my life I made it. I was a government 14. See, from humble beginnings to success. See? And my father couldn't make it, so he ate his heart out, literally. He developed a very serious drinking problem, a lot of anger, you know, very jaundiced, very bitter view of the world, I think. He tried to be optimistic. He worked really hard, but underneath it all, he felt like such a loser. Now, you know, if you could just step back and realize, you know, in 100 years, nobody's going to care about this issue. And in fact, now that my father's died, nobody cares about it now. It was all in his head, right? It's all in his head. So, you know, unfortunately, you know, my father was so worried about not becoming a GS-14 that he missed so many opportunities to encounter reality. You know, actually, he worked and worked and worked and worked, and he had very few opportunities to get outside of his fantasy world. Maybe the one time that he got outside his fantasy world was he decided that he was going to help organize the Boy Scouts. So my father became a scoutmaster, a chain-smoking scoutmaster. And he organized the Boy Scouts on our base, and we all went on a 50-mile hike. And it almost killed my poor dad because he was quite overweight. And he was in terrible shape. And walking 10 miles with a pack it almost killed him, you know. But, you know, out there in the natural world, my father did encounter something he'd never encountered before in his life. You know, and it really did move him very powerfully. He really loved it. And he was a city kid, or he was actually a New Jersey kid. He had grown up in Elizabeth. And when he started, when he took us on this hike, you could see he was really, it was like part of himself came awake that had been asleep since he was born, really. And so much of our true nature lies asleep, some people never awaken it, you know. Every once in a while, you know, people have breakthroughs, you know, like, typically, people can be very defensive, angry, busy, and maybe something happens to them, right? Like, they have a heart attack, and they almost die on the operating table. And people talk about this all the time. You know, they come out of the hospital and they go, my God, you know, I've missed out on so much of life. And often they have feelings of love sort of for their fellow human being. And they might spend the day listening to the wind, right? Or sitting on the porch and watching the leaves blow on a summer day. And it's because there's this part of themselves that was locked up in this fantasy world, and when you get out of it a little bit, you realize your life is bigger than these fantasies. You know, we would think it's tragic if somebody killed himself because he got a bad score on Diablo, right? You'd think that was crazy, but when you know, when people get very unhappy and very upset, it's often for things that are no more real than that. But they seem so compelling and so real because everybody tells us they're real. Everybody says, oh no, this is very, very important. So I have a friend of mine who is an associate professor. Now, just as humans love hierarchy, they love ranks, you know. So there's a lecturer. That lecturer doesn't have a permanent job. Then there's there's something called an assistant professor, and that person is given a possibility of a permanent job, but has to get tenure. And then there's an associate professor. Once you get tenure, you can be associate professor. And then if you can go all the way up, you can be a professor. And then at Rutgers, there's even higher rank. It's called a professor two. So you're like, not only you're professor, you know? So professor, you know, you say it twice. In India, there's somebody named Sri Ravi Shankar. And I thought, my God, Sri wasn't good enough for that guy. You know? He has to be Sri. Wow. He should be called Sri 2. He's a Sri 2. Wow, he must be really holy. Okay. So professor, right? So my friend is an associate professor, and he feels like a loser. Now look, just getting a professorship is so tough, and he's done some wonderful work. He's written a couple wonderful books, and he went up for promotion and he didn't get it, and he felt so depressed, right? And like, you know, he goes to as an analyst, and you know, he probably had to do many, many sessions with his analyst, you know, trying to work this through. I can tell him, you know, there's been a lot of brilliant people who were associate professors all their life, you know, and I know a lot of professors who, you know, they're already forgotten, you know, but that doesn't help, right? Because the game reinforces all of these values, and you know, the truth is, if you picked the most famous English professor of 30 years ago, and you asked the graduate students, have you read this person? Not a single person would have read him. And if, you know, so in other words, the top people are just, they write books that wind up in the libraries, and some poor student 100 years from now will be going through the library at Alexander Library, and he'll find these books that have never been checked out for 80 years by people who are like top professors in the English department right now. And he'll think, huh, that's a strange title. Never heard of the guy. And he'll put it back on the shelf. You know? So it's not much different from Diablo, really. And it's a great pity. So I think that people live in a very boxed up way, very trapped way. And they make themselves needlessly unhappy, and that there's this bigger life, which is like a returning to nature. You know, that world that we forgot all about is still there, you know, waiting for us. And you could go to Yosemite, you could say, okay, you're right, I'm going out to Montana, you know. But when you get to Montana, you could find that you're still just as haunted by your illusions as you were in New Jersey. So it's not so much a question of changing your place as stepping outside our fantasies and projections. And I think this is very, very important for human beings because we see in like the environmental crisis, we see that collision between the fantasy world of human beings and the natural world, and our inability to harmonize ourselves with the world as it actually is, which is this marvelous living world. And so, you know, it would be a great pity, wouldn't it, if many species went into extinction just so you could go to Walmart and get a pair of cheap socks, right? That would be a great pity. And of course, we all know that Walmart sells many things that no human being ever really needs. Yeah, it's like a world of fantasy again. It would be great if our society could wake up from its dreams, but societies can't do that. Only individuals can do that. So people have to, you know, maybe some people realize, you know, I'm not happy. I feel like my whole world is artificial, and I feel somehow that something's missing. And then you might come to Zazen, and you sit on the cushion, and you practice this path, and it's just possible that you have moments where the mind, the thinking machine, stops for a little while. You know, the dreaming machine, the thinking machine is really the dreaming machine. Thoughts are really just kind of dreaming, yeah? And so, you know, you're dreaming. And as you dream, you know, you have terrible fear or anger or, you know, whatever. But at some point you come in and you sit down on the cushion, and you might have a few moments where the dreaming machine just stops. And you can hear the wind, you know? And the wind seems so alive. So alive. And it's almost thrilling to listen to the wind. Isn't it? When you're open and your mind and body and heart are clear. Normally, we're too caught up in our collective dream to be in the moment. Yeah? But every once in a while, it becomes possible to be in the moment. And when we're prepared for it, and we're outside of the fantasy, something as simple as wind can just be like going to California, like going to, you know, Montana. It's absolutely thrilling. So part of Zen practice is exiting the dream and becoming, we say, becoming natural. So, we have to sort of go back to a kind of pure consciousness, pure awareness of the moment. It's the only way to decondition ourselves. So we sit on the cushion, and if you watch the breath and you follow the breath out, you'll notice that at the end of the breath there's these little spaces where your mind has no thoughts. This is such a lucky break, right? Because it means that we can step outside of the dream. And so you keep going into that state, and usually what happens is that the dreams come back a little bit because they have a really powerful hold over us, you know. So if you come to Sesshin and something is bothering you, you know, you might be trying to focus on the breath, but something might be bothering you. It might be the most trivial thing in the world, but it might just be nagging at you. So you keep going back to the breath, and little by little it goes away. It just goes away. And that's a real achievement, being able to but you know, a lot of Zen practice is just is loosening the hold of those illusions, you know, and when they're gone, you suddenly feel calm and stable, and you might even feel happy for no reason. Yeah? So same thing with mu practice. The word mu is a word, is just a word. It means nothingness. U or mu, mu in Japanese, u in Chinese. In Sanskrit, this is shunyata, shunyata. What this means is that we, we could say shu. See, you could be sitting there going shu, shu, like a shoe for your foot, you know, sneaker. That's too long though. So you could be saying shu, shu. The important thing is that you're fixing your attention on something so firmly that thoughts don't have an opportunity to arise. See? And in other words, the tape loops in your head, the movies in your head, don't have a chance to play. So each time they start trying to intrude on your awareness of the moment, you use the word mu to cut them off. So it's a little bit like somebody trying to say, hey, would you? But I just won't. Right? Like that. That's what you're doing, right? But I'm not a governor of food. I've got to. It's so important. Okay. That's kind of what you're doing, and you just don't let the little voice get a word in edgewise, right? You know, as it, and this is really good practice. This is in the great Zen master Xu Yun called this cutting away the creepers. See, like vines. So you know, these thoughts are like vines, right? If you start thinking, they just proliferate, right? And they just spread and spread and spread and spread. And they go very quickly, and pretty soon you're lost in thought, right? And this is like you're lost in thought, and guess what disappears? The world disappears, right? And you're in this fantasy realm, and you're having all of these conditioned responses. So if you were my dad, you'd be sitting there on the cushion thinking, maybe if I do Zazen, it will help me to become a government service 14. Yes, maybe that's my problem, you know. Oh, I have so many problems, I'll never be a 14, right? And then you think, oh, maybe I'm just not good enough. If only I were good enough, blah, 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 blah. See, so, you know, you just start, and then you have the fear, the anger, self-loathing, all these emotional responses. So you just have to cut it off. If you do this long enough, you know, you begin to have these moments where the mind is blank and dark, yeah, and this is so important, because this is the point at which you're encountering a deeper awareness, bigger consciousness, deeper consciousness. You have a little mind that forms pictures and works in language, and that's an artificial mind. But you have another mind that processes information in a much more effective and effective way. So your consciousness is like a tiny little circle, but your awareness is much bigger than that. People do many, many things without thinking about it consciously, you know. So we have a bigger intelligence, and much of it is asleep because we haven't ever used it in our lives, or we've used very little of it, you know. But the whole point of Zen practice is to bring to life all of those parts of the human being, or maybe I should say all of those parts of the universe that have been put to sleep by our culture, and our personal life decisions. So this is like waking up something very big, you know, something very wonderful. So today it's very important to do this practice of pruning the vines, and you know, if you keep doing this, you'll feel better. Don't have expectations. Just keep working away. Expectations are just thoughts again. Yeah. So it really is possible to be a different kind of human being with not trapped in illusion. You know, that really is possible. But it might almost seem impossible at first. But if you keep going, you'll be amazed at what happens. Jinso came to see Shifuku. Shifuku drew a circle in the air. Jinso said, "I have no object in coming here. Why do you bother to draw a circle?" Shifuku closed the door of the room. Now, Jinso was a very well-known layman. Not a monk or a nun, but just a regular Zen practitioner. And he, like Master Joshu, used to go around and challenge monks to see what their insight was. But unlike Master Joshu, he didn't have deep understanding. And so this is a story about Jinso. He came to see a monk named Shifuku. And Shifuku saw him and drew a circle in the air. And Jinso said, "I have no object in coming here. Why do you bother to draw a circle?" So he's kind of challenging him. He's saying, that shows you're not enlightened. Let me show you that I'm enlightened. And he said, you're drawing a circle. Is kind of like a futile gesture to show that you're awake. But actually, in this koan, Jinso is the one who's not awake. Because he doesn't understand what has happened, because he's using his discriminating intellect. See, he thinks he's getting somewhere, but he's really just thinking. He's comparing himself with others in order to say, "I'm better or worse," and so on and so on. So he's far from being awake. He's actually trapped in his fantasy. There's a little story. I'll just read it and then we'll stop. But this is a little story about Jinso, Shosho. His family name was Chin. So was his personal name. So he studied Zen with Bokushu. Jinso had a subtle understanding of Zen, and he would test the monks. None could cope with him. One day, Umon came, the great master Yunmen, empty cloud. Jinso said to him, "I shall not ask you about the teaching of the sutras, but I ask you, why do you journey to visit Zen masters?" So he's testing Umon. Umon said, "Put aside these questions for the moment. What is the Buddha's teaching?" And then Jinso says, "One is at a loss for words to expound it. One's mind is blocked when one tries to think about it." Umon said, "Being at a loss for words comes from using words. Being blocked comes from delusive thinking." So he's saying you're still trapped in your thinking. You're still saying enlightened, unenlightened. You know, good, bad, yes, no. Let it all go. Mushin. It says, "Tell me, what is the Buddha's teaching?" Okay? And Jinso could not answer. So he's not there yet. If you're sitting on the cushion and you have thoughts, it's not a crime. Okay? It's not a sin. It's okay. If you're sitting on the cushion and you're thinking, damn, this is great. That's okay. You know, please enjoy it. You know, enjoy it. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, if you're sitting on the cushion and you're thinking, "Ah, this is hell. I'm sorry for you." You know, keep going. It'll go away. But the point is, the essence of Zen practice is returning to that that blankness over and over again. However you get there, just staying there will be like taking the most wonderful medicine. You will feel so wonderful. You will feel so alive if you keep doing that. So please, everybody's doing a wonderful job today. And we're here at this precious opportunity to liberate ourselves. And let's make the most of it. But as I say, don't be hard on yourself. Just be natural. Wu wei, right? You go into the blankness. A thought is going to arise sooner or later. So you just say, okay, it's just a thought. Back to mu. Okay? Back to the breath. With another thought, no problem. And just don't assess, don't judge your performance. Just keep going and have a wonderful experience of freedom. All right?